memoir by Captain and Pilot C.A. Tony Self of the RCAF. Operation of June 6, 1944. This was a night trip, late on D-Day. Half the squadron had gone out the night before the landings took place on the Normandy coast. Our particular aim was to bomb the railway marshalling yards at Coutances on the Cherbourg Peninsula to help prevent the Germans moving men and armament to the western landing area. We were in Halifax 3G for George, serial number LW377, and this was to be a little trip with a late evening takeoff. As I recall, we had about 11,000 pounds of 500 and 1,000 pound bombs set to explode on impact. Possibly there were one or two set for delayed response. As we were on our way to the target over the English Channel at about 2,000 feet altitude, we were amazed on two counts. First, the channel was full of shipping going to the landings areas, and some coming back, no doubt. And second, we saw many aircraft, not bombers, coming back. These were mostly C-47 and C-46 transports used for dropping paratroops and equipment. We made our run-in from the west at 1,800 feet. Other bombers were above and below and to the sides. Just before the time came for my bomb aimer to release our bombs, there was a stunning impact and a stream of fire from just behind me and to my left. I thought at first we'd been hit by anti-aircraft fire, flak, and fought to control the aircraft. I pushed the appropriate fire extinguisher button for the port inner engine and pulled the jettison toggle for backup bomb release. I got the aircraft on a level keel, the fire went out, and the mid-upper gunner reported that apparently a 500-pound bomb had gone through the wing, leaving a large hole between the port inboard engine and the fuselage, somehow missing the two 500-pound bombs we carried there. The bomb had hit flat, not exploding, so the aircraft from which it came had been close above. I checked the damage after turning southward away from the flak guns around the target. I'd already found I couldn't close the bomb doors, so the hydraulics were gone. The port aileron was inoperative, reducing my control over the aircraft. I'd feathered or stopped the port inboard engine as part of the fire extinguishing procedure. It had stopped firing. Anyway, so it hadn't been getting petrol because the line was damaged. I was now down to just over 1,000 feet, and we could just maintain that altitude on three engines with the open bomb bay doors creating much drag. A few minutes later, my port outer engine quit, and I couldn't maintain control without going into a descending turn to the left. Just as I was about to feather or stop the port outer engine, which was windmilling uselessly, causing drag, it fired up again with a roar. Apparently, with the wing down, it was getting some fuel it couldn't get with the wings level. I clawed for altitude, got a couple of 100 feet, and asked my navigator for a heading for the nearest point on the English coast. It was Bold Head, between Dartmouth and Plymouth on the Devon coast. My radio operator, Ross Bielby, got hold of an emergency frequency and told him we were going to try and make the coast. The dilemma was that we were losing petrol, and I could stop that by having the flight engineer shut off all fuel to the port side, but that would mean I would lose the port outboard engine altogether, and we'd have to ditch somewhere in the English Channel where the water was cold, and I'd have to do a two-engine ditching. It made more sense to leave the fuel flowing and have partial use of the port outboard engine. We had about 100 miles to go. I didn't know yet how quickly we were losing fuel. But a couple of minutes later, the port outboard quit again, and down we went. And then it fired up again, and we struggled for altitude. It was hard work flying a four-engine aircraft with no power controls under these conditions, and the bomb aimer helped me on the aileron control while I was moving trimming controls back and forth. I'd become aware that the dinghy storage area was partially where the bomb went through the wing, and so a ditching wouldn't have worked anyway. With bomb doors open, the aircraft probably would have sunk almost immediately. We proceeded across the channel in this erratic fashion, falling and pulling up again. An airfield somewhere up ahead was prepared to take us in, but everything ahead was blacked out. I couldn't be sure where I was. It took an hour to cross the 100 miles of water. Just as we approached the cliffs, or the coast, my flight engineer told me he figured we had perhaps 5 minutes fuel left. I decided then that once we were over land, I would bail everyone out rather than run the risk of running out of fuel and doing a dead stick forced landing on a pitch black countryside, which is normally a fatal procedure. As we crossed the coast, the port outboard engine quit again, and we went down very steeply towards the rocks below where I could see the white foam. When we were at about 400 feet, The port outboard started up belatedly, and I regained control. I'd had the crew line up ready to dive out of the escape hatch in the nose. Only a couple were plugged into the intercom system. As we were going down towards the surf below, I said to anybody who was listening, "Well, I guess we've had it." There was silence, and then when the port outboard engine fired up, I started to ease the cut up and said, "Maybe we haven't." There was a faint cheer from somebody. I got the airplane up to about 600 feet above the land and about a half mile inland and started bailing everyone out. Then I let the kite swing around towards the coast. I trimmed it up for a gentle glide, which I hope would take it out to the sea, and climbed from my seat, getting my parachute harness hung up on the big undercarriage control lever, which stuck up below the right-hand side of the pilot seat. I pulled this loose, climbed down into the nose. I looked at the black hole of the escape hatch for a second, and then dived out. I must have pulled the ripcord a little too soon, because when I was jolted upright, I saw the kite quite close above me. The trailing antenna was still hanging below the aircraft. This was a long wire with a heavy weight on the end, but I and the others missed that, too. As we were not very high, there was a strong desire to get the parachute inflated. I had only swung a couple of times and then hit heavily by a stone wall and a gravel pile. I'd tried to miss these objects and landed quite hard, but apparently was intact. Later I found I'd hurt my back, but that, as they say, is another story. The aircraft had headed back towards the sea and apparently made a good landing in some medium-depth water just offshore. Somehow, some of it has now been salvaged. I rolled up my parachute, left it under a bush, and found a lane heading back to the coast, and finally a coast road. There was no traffic, and when I came to a village, it was deserted. Very eerie. I walked on and came to the other deserted houses where I imagined I could hear faint voices of, I hoped, birds calling me. I resisted the temptation to go down these dark entry roads to the sinister houses with their strange noises and walked on. Finally, I came to a barricade and a live village on the other side where a village bobby took me to his house for a cup of tea with his wife. There were searchers out in the countryside, and one by one, my crew members were picked up and we were taken to a Spitfire field near Bolthead. I was impressed during the last crucial hour or so by how coolly everyone appeared to be taking it. I was somewhat terrified myself, but fortunately was too busy to do my brooding. During the rest of our tour of operations, we had a fair number of emergencies and alarms, but this one, on our ninth trip, was one to particularly remember. By Tony Self.